All right. Please continue to eat and enjoy your lunch. But while you do that, we're going to have a sponsored session given by Jason Mitchell from ATI about data amplification, and he'll explain exactly what all that means. I do just want to say the forks tend to be kind of loud in situations like this, so be a little bit conscious and kind of mellow with the forks as we're eating. And aside from that, take it away, Jason.
Thanks, John. Can you guys hear me in the back okay? All right, cool. Again, my name's Jason Mitchell. I work in the 3D Application Research Group at ATI. And I just kind of wanted to, I realized when I made this talk that you're going to have forks rather than pens and things. So I didn't want to be super, super technical and make you have to take lots of notes and think really hard about this kind of stuff. So what I really want to do is actually kind of take a fairly random walk through the kind of broad topic of data amplification, because I know this is something on people's minds right now. And hopefully there'll be some little nuggets that you haven't seen before. So first I'll talk about what I really mean by this and why we're motivated to talk about data amplification, and then move into areas where we can use textures for data amplification, such as compositing signals together, maybe hybrid procedural and authored approaches, things like Wang tiles, and also flow-based synthesis of textures. Then we'll move on to talk about geometry synthesis and geometry processing, including things like ocean water synthesis, which I'll talk quite a bit about because that's something I've done recently, and also mention particle systems and instancing, and then kind of conclude with one existence proof that I'm aware of, which is a game that's in development called Graphen. The demo that I was just kind of rolling there while people were eating with the guys running through there, that was using sort of an instancing trick that we did on just sort of vanilla DirectX 9 that I'll talk about a little bit as we go. So the motivation for selecting a topic like this is that the market demands larger, more complex stuff, right? You guys want to build bigger, more complicated worlds, but you still have constraints, budget constraints, so you want to be able to do this efficiently if you can. Data amplification might be one way. Additionally, the GPUs can consume ever-increasing amounts of data, so you want to load data in and then try and reuse it in an interesting way, using the GPUs that are increasing in power. The kind of issues that you face are, first of all, the cost of authoring these things is getting more and more expensive, and so we want to try and get more out of what we build. Additionally, at any one moment on some platform, say some constrained, console-type environment, or on a PC, your hard drive or your DVD and your volatile RAM are relatively slow compared to the appetite of the GPU. And so you want to be able to load in data and then reuse it in interesting ways. And so we want to amplify it. The term database amplification, as far as I'm aware anyways, comes from this Alvy Ray Smith paper from 84 from SIGGRAPH, where he talked a lot about plants and fractals and kind of talked about the data amplification rate, kind of looking at, or ratio, kind of looking at what he stored in memory initially, what his data set really kind of was, and then what he was able to kind of get out in the end. Let's say how many particles or vertices or things he generated later on based on his initial concise description. The paper also talks about emergence, which is just the appearance of complexity based on just very simple rules. Like, so if you're at all familiar with L systems, these are very concise, but they can describe complex, whole species of plants really, really concisely. Probably the simplest thing that people are familiar with in the area of data amplification is procedural textures, compositing different signals together, such as Perlin noise, at different octaves, different weightings, different scaling, scrolling things around, and so on, just playing games with noise to get sort of amorphous natural phenomena, such as clouds like you see there. That particular image is actually from a chapter that appears in Game Programming Gems 5 that will be coming out in the spring. where the synthesis of the clouds was done in a relatively straightforward manner, just straight out of Perlin's SIGGRAPH 85 paper. It was done by Jean-François Dubé at Ubisoft in Montreal. But the kind of the novel thing that he did was some lighting from the top. So he used loops and pixel shaders to actually sort of trace rays through these synthesized clouds, which is that's kind of the novel thing there. So that's kind of something to look for when that comes out. We'll also talk about some hybrid approaches. Point out a paper that was recently done on Wang tiles, which is kind of similar to some techniques you guys may already be doing, but it's worth pointing out. And then I'll go into more detail on flow-based synthesis and Fourier domain water synthesis. Sean Barrett had a chapter in Game Developer Magazine recently talking about kind of the middle ground between having your artist paint all your brick textures or whatever, you know, material textures for your environment, and then being able to make those look unique in your world by compositing other signals with them. Many of you may already be doing things like this with detail textures in your games already. Actually, I'm kind of surprised at how few games really do seem to do that, as far as I'm aware, of just really compositing different signals together to break up patterns. And this can be done at like a micro detail level or a macro detail level. I know people kind of mix those things together. But the point is, you don't have to think of procedural techniques or as mutually exclusive from sort of authored techniques. You should be able to find some middle ground. There was a paper by Michael Cohen at SIGGRAPH in 03 on a topic called Wang tiles. These are something that have existed for a while. And you can come up with these tiles that have these rules that govern how their different edges can meet up to each other. And you can use them to aperiodically tile a space. So you can have this finite set of stuff. So for example, if you look in the top right hand of the slide, you'll see there's a set of like 18 little tiles, like 6x3 array of tiles there. And those are different from each other. And they have rules that govern which ones can meet up with which other ones on which edges. And you can use those to just generate arbitrarily many daisies in your field, and so that other rectangle to the right, the larger one, is made up of those tiles, and you can't see obvious patterns in there yet. You still have finite stuff, which is kind of an interesting thing to think about, right? And as you have ever more complex pixel shaders, you know, you can think of spending some of that power on this kind of data amplification, not just moving to, you know, spherical harmonics or, you know, lighting with zillions of different lights simultaneously, or kind of all the obvious lighting advancements that you would do with longer pixel shaders. But you can do other more interesting things like this as well, because you're probably faced more with challenges of just making your stuff fit in memory than with writing complex lighting algorithms, I would imagine. Other examples, down in the bottom there, you have kind of this kind of Poisson dot distribution looking thing or whatever, or like sort of dither pattern-y looking thing. And that's all made up actually from this little set of eight Wang tiles, which is pretty cool. You probably don't have a lot of little dither dot things in your game, like textures that look like that, but you can think of it for placement. So all those sunflowers in the right-hand image there are generated from these kind of distributions, these little chunks. So for each dot in one of those little eight original tiles there, you could make a chunk O world geometry where there's a sunflower coming up from each dot, and then just tile those babies together to make your world, and it looks natural, but it's a repetition of that geometry, right? Another paper that was at SIGGRAPH this year, which when you, on the face of it, you don't necessarily think of it as a data amplification technique that you might want to apply to games. It's actually really framed as a video synthesis paper, where they went out to Snoqualmie Falls and took some reference footage down in the bottom left there. And then in this other image here, they went and they kind of drew some flow lines on the image. They said that basically stuff is going from here to here along these kind of lines and then coming out. And then later on, they went in with Photoshop and kind of made a backdrop image and then drew these red lines to say, well, we want more stuff to follow these red lines, and they're able to synthesize video from that. I'll show you a video of that, I hope. Right. So they have actually a very short loop. You can see it like loop back around every like second or a couple of seconds there of this waterfall. But yet they're able to make this seamless scene over here. And I think you could imagine that if there were a way to author this, you could make a particle system in your game follow the same kind of rules, and use this as a way to generate some really nice looking, very concise backdrops in your games. And the way that this is done is they look along those flow lines that the user drew, those blue flow lines, to just kind of mark the initial videos. And they basically look at those lines and kind of trace particles along those lines and then extract out from the different video frames as one of their particle traverses the different basically textures that you would want that particle to be textured with as it followed that flow line. And they come up with this basically little flipbook animation set of particle textures that in their video synthesis step that they do later on, they then basically synthesize particles to follow these new red flow lines and then texture them with the appropriate particle from that kind of point on the path. It's a pretty straightforward and simple concept. I think the authoring step is probably the biggest bear, actually. But they've also shown kind of an example here where you can integrate this into 3D scenes, which I think is kind of cool. So here it is without. It's kind of there. They just have a simple little pan, and they have a particle system in there that's going to drive their video synthesis. That's their original, and then they take the particles that came from that other shot and make them follow this. So they're able to composite in. I mean, because there's not really any good view dependence factored into the way that this was authored, it tends to look a little bit like you kind of stuck some video into your 3D scene. But it's very economical, and I would imagine for a lot of scenarios that would work pretty well. So I think that's worth looking at. One thing to mention is that, you know, in coming APIs and in hardware, you're going to see a new kind of texture construct called a texture array, and this is essentially an array of 2D textures which have their own independent mipmaps. It's not a volume texture, right? A volume texture, the way that a volume texture has its mipmaps created, you kind of get crosstalk, but you can't think of it as independent slices, each with their own mipmap, right? Because the mipmaps go down in sort of that third dimension as well. So this is different from a volume texture, but you can kind of think of it similarly in that you access it with a 3D texture coordinate. You have your U and your V, and then another texture coordinate that says sort of what your array index is. So one thing that's nice about that is you could draw this whole particle system, and each particle could know which frame of animation it should be on, and you should be able to just draw this entire thing in one shot. So there's not basically this reduces texture changes for things like particle systems, where you can easily encode into the data which texture it should be using. So that's kind of a really nice thing, and I'll come back again to this concept when I talk about instancing later on. Another way that you can look at synthesizing textures for little, you know, decorative wispy smoky things in your environments is to use a Navier-Stokes simulation. And I know it sounds silly and scary to talk about using something so heavyweight for something as frivolous as smoke around your environment, but that's actually exactly what was happening in that crowd demo that I showed. We're actually off-screen running a Navier-Stokes simulation in a kind of relatively small 2D texture, maybe like 128 squared or something, and then texturing it onto these kind of extruded sort of ellipse kind of dealies, like these sort of squashed cylinders, and so you get that nice wispy smoke. It takes a while to load, so maybe I'll run the crowd demo later on and point that out when we run it later. But essentially, once you have this tool in your toolbox, you know, you can just use it, and we'll give you this tool. I mean, this is an SDK sample that we wrote. We have a screensaver that uses this that I think is just being released this week with Source, and you can just steal the routines that do this. So that's kind of a fun thing. So And I guess, yeah, and so, and all additionally, you know, I'm talking about this as textures, and kind of up to this point in the talk, we're all kind of implicitly thinking of texels as texels and not as anything else, like not as geometry or vertices, and thinking of them as essentially only accessible to that part of the pipeline, the graphics pipeline that we up till now have thought of them being accessible by, if that makes sense. On future platforms where vertices and pixels and texels are basically just all data elements, you can think of this as part of gameplay, perhaps. And we've actually implemented a prototype platform that we call Fluid Pong, where we basically have a little Pong ball and two little hoses that you can move up and down and squirt fluid into the field, and affect the you know, basically the vertices of that little Pong thing, with this Navier-Stokes fluid simulation that's running totally on the rasterizer. So the entire thing is done on the GPU. And yeah, so here's an example of where that is in that crowd scene. I'll show it interactively later on, but down in the bottom right is just a static shot of the fluid simulation we have running. We have put a force going upward, and we put little droplets into the bottom of it, so it gives kind of a smoke flowing upward look. Okay, so it's fun to play games with textures. Textures are cool, but they're only part of the problem. We want to amplify our geometry, and we can think of doing this in a couple of ways. One, we can synthesize more, maybe, in some cases, just make it from nothing. Or in other cases, we can just reuse the data that we do author. We do still have stables of artists who have to painstakingly make neat stuff, but maybe we can re-instance and retarget that stuff so we can make it populate our world more. So first I'll talk about geometry synthesis, so just making data, making geometry out of some procedural description. Essentially, currently, you know, you can do image processing on textures, on images very, very easily. I mean, I think we've been doing this for years now, essentially, at this point, especially once we got floating point textures and we could start to do some HDR-ish kind of things. And you know, in which you want to generally apply some bloom and fun stuff like that. And for certain one-to-one or many-to-one operations, even today you can do geometry processing. Although the APIs are in denial about this. As soon as we gave you floating point textures, we gave you geometry processing. But D3D and OpenGL, unfortunately, are well and truly behind the times when it comes to this. We want to synthesize data on demand in some cases, you know, if we can, rather than store a lot of it. Jay, can I talk about what your memory footprint is for your water normal map? Okay, it's like between 10 and 20 megabytes, right? In video memory, sitting there, waiting to be used on the water in Half-Life 2. And that's memory you'd like to get back if you can. So it's finite resolution. It's something like 256 squared, right? And it's just a flipbook animation, which, of course, loops back around. I mean, it looks great. It's really lovely. They did a good job synthesizing that up front. But it's finite resolution in time and space. You'd like to not have that constraint if you can, and also get back that video memory if you can. So let's talk about how we might do that. So some things we've done in the past that we've shown in some demos of ours is doing things like, in the spatial domain, summing together sinusoids. That's a fairly straightforward thing to do. We've used vertex shaders to evaluate, say, just a small number, like maybe four sine waves, and scroll them around, and let the superposition give you neat-looking gross movement of your ocean water. And then on top of that, you can maybe layer a normal map, which exists in tangent space, and so then in your shader you can do things like, you know, get everything in the right space and bump map your animating water, and that's pretty cool. But we can do better. Historically, there have been a couple different approaches to synthesizing ocean water. There's spatial domain stuff, like I just described, where you actually take spatial domain sine waves, sum them together, get the superposition, and just use them directly. You can also use trochoids, which are they're not sinusoids; they're periodic, though. They're the kind of thing that your kid would draw if you asked them to draw the ocean. It's that shape with the crests. Yeah, Those are trochoids. Then there's also Fourier domain classes of ocean water synthesis. It turns out the oceanography community has actually known for a while what the Fourier spectrum of ocean water looks like. And in the late 80s, some computer graphics guys got wind of this and decided to kind of crib off of that. And this paper by Mastin, they basically would take white noise that you see in the top top right-hand side of the slide there, and take the Fourier transform of it to just bring it into the Fourier domain, and then filter it with this particular spectrum that's called the Pearson-Moskowitz spectrum, and this is the thing that oceanographers knew about, right? This is the thing that they sort of measured and could use to describe the natural spectrum of ocean water. Deep ocean water with no shore interactions and things like that. So you can then essentially use that to filter this transformed white noise, do the inverse Fourier transform, and you get out water height. Strange as that sounds, you actually get out a reusable chunk of tileable ocean water that you can use as a height map for one point in time. And it's a tileable one, right? Because by definition, when you're taking the inverse Fourier transform of this, you're getting a periodic signal at that period of the size of the image you're talking about there, which is pretty slick. It means you can tile it across a space and it works. Yes? So the question was about... crack fixing between tiles. I guess if you treated it as geometry and simply translated the stuff, I guess, you know, floating point error would build up. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, if you just instanced them, you could, depending on how you handled the floating point, I think you could potentially get errors in between. But for the most part, if you're going to do this with geometry, you want to treat those cells as kind of your vertices rather than, if you see what I mean. And the mesh needs to sort of borrow from the last row and column. Yeah, you have to stitch that up. If you're going to sample from this with a mesh, you need to seam things up so they don't. And in my demo, you see that I got lazy and did not do that. I'll show that. In 99, Tessendorf talked at SIGGRAPH, and I think he's talked given this talk at SIGGRAPH pretty much every year since then in the Natural Phenomena course. About using this similar kind of approach in movies like Waterworld and Titanic and a bunch of others since then. In this case, he actually starts in the Fourier domain, so he doesn't have to do a Fourier transform of white noise. He can generate noise in the Fourier domain. And of course, by definition, this is giving you a sum of sinusoids. I mean, that's kind of the point of an inverse Fourier transform rather than trochoids. So it tends to give you slightly smoother water than would be natural. And the cool thing about this technique is you can evaluate it at time t without having to evaluate it any other time. So, you know, in the example of a game that has basically a flipbook animation of water, instead of looking to that flipbook and saying, what time am I, and maybe grabbing the nearest frame or nearest two frames or something, it can just call this, you know, routine that uses the GPU at time t to synthesize water. And it doesn't have to repeat. You can make it so it repeats if you want to, but it's not necessary. It uses a different spectrum called the Phillips spectrum, which is, I think, fairly an arbitrary choice, although it may have been selected because it gives you some neat knobs you can tweak to sort of control the roughness of the sea and wind speed and that kind of stuff. And some game developers in 01 at the European Game Developers Conference, and then I think they published this at Gamma Sutra in some form, took a lot of that stuff and did a bunch of it on the CPU at kind of much lower resolutions than Tessendorf was looking at for the Waterworld and Titanic stuff. But this was kind of the first Fourier synthesis of ocean water attempt that was a real-time one. And they also did some. They did a ton of other neat stuff by like playing with foam and spray and caustics and God rays. A God ray is when you're underwater and you look up and you see the sun and you get those neat streaks. It's similar. You can draw those in similar ways to the way that people have done light through particles. The light shafts, that kind of stuff. Now, recently, though, people have started to do FFTs and, of course, IFFTs on the GPU. So once you have this kind of collision of floating point textures and floating point pixel pipelines with this history of Fourier synthesis of signals in general, but in this case, ocean water, boom, you basically get ocean water synthesis on the graphics processor. If you can feel free. Okay. That's okay. Go ahead. Uh-huh. Right. Sure. You think? Are you GPU limited? It's an interesting. I mean, it's definitely an interesting question. And, like, it's a whole overarching system question. And as a GPU vendor, I tend to like live in denial, right? And say that, you know, I want you to run your stuff on my processor. But yeah, excellent question. Absolutely excellent question. So I think this is an area that remains to be thrashed out. But I think that Part of the procedurally synthesized stuff won't need to be fed back. Like, for example, like in this case, just think of it as the high frequencies of the signal. So, for example, you could do things like maybe do like a dual band approach, which I'll actually discuss, where you could either do like low frequencies on the GPU and feed them back, or do it in both places, do low frequencies on the CPU and use those for collision geometry for your junk that's flying into the water or sailing on the water, where the little high frequency waves, the little perturbations look awesome but don't affect the trajectory of anything, or, you know, where something's floating or bobbing or causing wake or whatever. It's a good question. I mean, definitely, like, the academic community that's been publishing a lot of GPGPU papers in the last couple years has done some really interesting stuff, but it is somewhat questionable from the whole system architecture point of view. And, you know, could you get that stuff back to the CPU in any kind of time frame that's meaningful? The hope is that PCI Express helps that out to some extent. But even then, like, there's like synchronization issues that doesn't make this an obvious slam dunk in every case, for sure. The Intel guy in the back. Nice.
two comments. One, maybe a little bit. The first one being that, you know, this kind of discussion of does it need to be fed back or not is really is not so much a bus thing as that current implementation. The real discussion is, for any given algorithm, does it or does it not map to a streaming type of architecture, and is there a lot of.
Oh, this is absolutely true. Yeah.
And that's kind of the whole discussion on that side. And then the other kind of disconnect we have on the GPU boundaries or not is just another implementation of the PC scalability problem. You're not limited on your super $400 big high end thing, but limited elsewhere. And I don't think that people are excited about writing implementations where on one system I offload it to another system.
It's an interesting point. I mean, I would imagine that some developers here are targeting very specific platforms where they maybe don't have to think about scalability. And so maybe in that case, it's easier to maybe just write off some of that.
Change and be choppy in one place, all these complexities, and it's translating from
Definitely a challenge. I'll talk about adding some of that stuff and show a demo of some of that stuff. And we're definitely continuing more. You had a question over here?
Well, on the same discussion but slightly different, this goes back to your original assertion that you want to make this cheap and easy for the artist to be able to create. Well, I'm in a world of I make the tool for artists to create all these assets, Max. We've been messing around with the concept of GPGPU, but when it comes down to it, without an appropriate software framework, it is neither cheap nor easy for me to be able to build all these algorithms that, on the one hand, I have to build them as GPU constructs, and then when the artist comes to actually begin to edit them because they don't like a particular look or something like that, I have to re-implement this in the CPU code. And now, how do I get around the fact that I now have two source code bases, one of which has to be Intel, 32-bit non-streaming, and the other one is streaming API or NVIDIA. And that's one problem that I would like to see flattened in Europe.
Yeah, it's a very good question. I would hope that things like the Brook project that's going on at Stanford, I don't know if you saw that paper by Ian Buck at SIGGRAPH this year, become more commonplace in the sense that people can sort of step back a level for these and not worry about the one-to-one pixel-texel thing and like all the gross stuff you have to do when you want to do GPU side coding. But from my point of view, honestly, like it was, it's a pain in the ass to like. Parallelize, like you can't compete with the GPU as far as simplicity of writing parallel things that are inherently parallel. Like there are many steps to this. I have the FFTW library, for example, where some guys have spent a lot of time implementing the Fourier transform on CPUs and it kicks ass. But there's other steps to this algorithm that are similar to that that I don't want to take the time to write at SSE code and worry about all the complexity of all of that. For me, it's a filter, right? It's an HLSO function. It's like this long, and it's already automatically parallel. So I mean, you don't necessarily want to run both places. I could see for a tool where you want reproducibility or fallback cases and things like that. It's sensible. It is unfortunate that there's not better APIs for GPGPU stuff. I agree. All right. Let me cruise on a little more, and you guys can feel free to throw your hands up though if there's more questions or just in disgust. I don't know, one or the other.
Did we interrupt you before you got to show us the demo?
I'm almost there. Yeah, but it doesn't do everything you're asking for, but it does a couple of them. So of course now that we can do an FFT, let's do what we want to do. We can basically every frame we can generate the Fourier spectrum at time t. So that's some Fourier domain, a couple rendered texture passes there. Do the IFFT, which is several passes, but you can do, I can do in this app an IFFT on, actually I can do the whole process on both a 256 squared and a 64 squared, because I actually do two to do different bands of things at 170 hertz. And this is on X800. So that's just like, that's the raw, what you can do, IFFTs. That's once you turn off all the rendering and stuff, because that's actually what's limiting the performance in this case. Then in this case, you can actually generate the normals directly from the Fourier description with another IFFT. I chose to just run my little Sobel cross product thing here in the spatial domain to generate a normal map. Then the key part is that D step there, which is where you cast your height field, which is what you got out in this image, grayscale image, to a vertex buffer. Boom, that's the part you can't do right now, which kind of sucks. Then render these mesh tiles using this, we think of it now as a vertex stream rather than a texture map to just displace your stuff. But I have a special driver that allows me to do that business, where I can cast a texture to a vertex buffer, or however you want to think about it. Sorry? You did not, likely. Not right now, anyways. So you can apply this synthesized height field to vertices. So let's run the demo. Let's see, where is it? Over here. So you can, by default, it actually has the wake map scrolling across it. This is a 3x3 grid, So it's, you can see it's repeating there, hopefully. And this is actually showing, this is showing only the low band, actually. So the normals are in a map, but they're the normals to this mesh that you can see here. And it's a 64 by 64 sort of element chunk. I can turn the wake off there, and you can just kind of see what's going on. And I can do things like maybe turn it down a little bit to get maybe like a pond or something that's, or just lower wind speed is really what that is. Or just crank the hell out of it, get some roiling seas. And you can see up here my height map and my normal map that gets filtered from that. So I mean, this is really real. This is kind of programmer art. You could probably do better with your art staff, but it is really real. You really can do it. And on next-gen, you know, platforms and things, I expect it, you could do it even more commonplace. And like I said, for some of the interactivity stuff, you can do things like maybe have a multi-resolution approach where you have a CPU side 64 by 64 FFT that you can just do really easily and use that to make your ship wobble or something. Or, you know, if you chuck stuff into this water, maybe you could take play back some pre-canned splash animations. Like, that's what I was doing with this little wake map, just scrolling it across my height map that I got out and then ran my normal map filter after that. I know that that's basically the way that they did the some aspects of the mud jacuzzi scene in Shrek 2. There was a neat sketch at SIGGRAPH this year where basically a compositor guy talked about how he did that scene. Like, he used their compositing tools. And he thinks in image space and images, and he was not above hand painting flipbook animations of mud plops and stuff that he went and composited into the in the height field sort of space of that mud jacuzzi, timed with, you know, other events and things like that. So I think you can do some reasonably neat stuff with just kind of image compositing in sort of the middle of this algorithm. You could easily imagine as well, like, if the waves are kind of flowing in this way and you've got a dock pier, you know, kind of thing coming down, take that Navier-Stokes fluid thing and just shoot it past a little obstacle and get some neat little eddy wake things out and composite those in as well. And I think there's a lot of games to be played here. One thing that I did was this sort of single versus multi-band approach. And to talk just a little bit more, I guess, implementation details, I start out with these two different textures. This is kind of notation from that Tessendorf paper where the top one there is amplitude, and these are phase. And the only input to this every frame is time. These two textures are static. So I take those two static textures, time, run them through this little kernel, which is implemented as just an HLSL pixel shader that maps from one image onto another to get the Fourier spectrum at a particular time, do my canned IFFT, which I already, you know, already have, and I get out my height map for that particular time. I can use this low band one as displacements, and if I want to do another one, I can, you know, use this as normals. Another thing you can do is have two normal maps. You can have a high-frequency normal map and a low-frequency normal map, and you can play some games possibly similar to the stuff that that John Ratcliffe was talking about, where you can have shore effects where, I don't know, the place where I jog, there's lily pads around in the pond, and I observe that on the other side of the lily pads, you have higher frequency stuff than you do on the shore side of the lily pads. And there's also just shore effects due to this, the depth of the water affecting the depth of the pond affecting it. So you can do some silly things like have your low band and your, I call it a broad band, because it also has these low band frequencies in it, but it has additional high frequency ones, and just blend between them. And so you can get some neat effects there as well. It's just a silly blend between the normal maps and so on. But it gives you the right look. It looks pretty slick. While you're doing all this junk, you can also generate caustics from it. It's not something that I've done yet, but Joost Stam has some stuff online where, you know, you basically have this mesh that you just synthesized here, right? And every one of those little gaps in the chicken wire is kind of catching some light, and according to Snell's law, refracting it, and it's coming down at some angle and then accumulating onto this little sort of, think of it as a little sensor at the bottom there that accumulates your caustics. So you should be able to play some games with these meshes to make repeatable caustic textures as well while you're doing all of this. They'll be correlated with your water, which is kind of fun, because if you care, like in some scenes you would actually, just below the shallow water, you'd see caustics that actually correspond to the junk that's above them, which is pretty slick. But you can also do just more arbitrary stuff, like just put a little lamp down here under your boat and project your synthesized tileable caustics up on there. That'll just vary every frame, which is kind of cool. And nobody painted any of this stuff. It's all noise and algorithms. So I think we already talked about the interaction thing. Some other stuff I just kind of want to point out before we finish up. I haven't delved nearly as deeply into the remaining topics here. There was a neat paper called Geometry Images, where meshes can be certain genuses of meshes can be reparameterized into a square, basically. And so now you can start to think of meshes as images, and you can do different things to them, and they have implicit neighbors as well, so you don't even really need an index buffer or anything, you automatically know who the neighbors are. And in this case, you can store also your positions and normals at different spatial resolutions, which is kind of a neat idea. Can anybody tell what that is? It's the bunny, correct. There have been some other papers that came after this one where they would actually go and on the CPU side animate that low resolution position thing, like do some things that were not equivalent to skinning or morphing or any of the kind of normal things you do to a vertex mesh currently, and then upload that relatively concise thing, smooth it, and then draw the smoothed out mesh. I think additionally this kind of mindset is I think going to probably apply also to the way people do facial animation. It's surprisingly not something we talked about in the last 2 days at the character rendering seminar, but I think facial animation and doing it well and doing it on a coprocessor, which is the GPU, is also an interesting topic going forward. And you can, because the neat thing about facial animation that makes it a little different is that the visemes tend to be kind of sparse, right? You want to apply, the eyebrow raise thing only to a small set of the vertices on the whole head mesh. And so you don't just stream all your visemes in at once because there's crap loads of zeros in there and it's a big waste, right? Yes. Oh, the geometry images? Oh, well, this one is not necessarily the way you would go in your game today, but I think it's more or less, instead, more of an indication of maybe how to think about geometry processing, in the sense that you could reparameterize a mesh and apply other tools like image processing tools to it. Like the example I gave, the smooth geometry images paper by Lasasso at, I think, SIGGRAPH 02, they took their bunny and they did all kind of other kinds of animations to it, things that would have been hard to do with just skinning or other kinds of, do you understand what I mean? So then, and that was on a low resolution mesh in the sense it was a small position buffer, and then they could essentially expand that out and use I think they use like Tobin smoothing or something to interpolate between those positions, so they had a higher resolution smoother version of that essentially, I think, decompressed kind of on the GPU. You could think of it also as a higher order surface almost, right? Tessellation, and then they applied their normal map. You could process the normal map as well, I guess, in that case. This is not necessarily, I'm not saying like run out and do all your trees or your rocks or your characters as geometry images. I'm mostly just pointing out like the nexus of image processing and geometry processing. That's kind of the point of this one. But I think the whole viseme thing is really ripe. I just want to go through a laundry list. This is somewhat of a random walk through topics that are related to data amplification, like particle systems obviously are one. We have some simple rules, some emitters, and very concise stuff, and you get waterfalls and fires and smokes and all kind of crazy stuff out of these things. So you really amplify your data. I guess these guys here used structured particle systems. That is, they weren't just used for things like water and smoke. But one cool thing that I wanted to point out is these guys get a 3,000x data amplification rate. Essentially, that they bothered to go and do the math as far as like what their initial data set was and then what they were able to generate. Which is pretty crazy, just try and think about that kind of multiplier on your data sets. I don't know if that's achievable for games because of so many other constraints, but just think about back the envelope calculations of what your data amplification rates are going forward. Now maybe you can't do Andre and Wally B type particle systems, but you do want to do probably falling snow and a bunch of other kinds of things that are typical in games. And there was a neat paper this year at Eurographics that used the graphics processor to implement a particle engine that they call Uberflow. They handled things like particle-particle and particle-scene collisions, so that snow actually accumulates on there and also is sorted back to front. Which is pretty insane. Which that part is really the reason this paper got in. It's because they came up with an optimization to the Bitonic merge sort that could be implemented on the GPU. So that's, I don't know if that's a million particles, but I have perf numbers for a million particles. Those are being sorted and they are being collided with that height field and with each other. Not that that really matters in this case. Actually, they probably aren't in this one.
They only do they retain them all, or do they then aggregate them into the
polygon? There's probably like a circular buffer or something, actually, more likely. I don't think it's not really a snow simulator. It's a particle simulator that happens to use that one application. But yeah, I think you could do more of that. Right, so here are some perf numbers. So with a million polygons, they're able to actually do like pretty neat get some pretty neat performance without collisions. Turning on collisions with that height field, you can still run at things like 42 hertz with a million. So for certain classes of particle systems that, again, don't affect gameplay and don't, in a dramatic way and don't have all these sort of feedback effects that you're asking about earlier, you could offload that as well. So besides generating things, which is probably a little bit more of a questionable and dubious thing, both to fit into your art pipeline and also just to again, deal with these interaction issues. Aside from that synthesis stuff, we can also talk about instancing. And you guys are probably already doing tons of this. I'm certain that you're doing tons of this in your games already, but not at the kind of the level that I'm talking about, and particularly sort of below the API level and essentially almost down at the hardware rendering level. The whole idea is to use a single source model, it's a great way to handle things like the crowd that I showed earlier, or anything like foliage, stuff that's really repetitive and self-similar. Ideally, you do this with one API call, and in fact, there was a modification made to Direct3D's interpretation of an existing API entry point in a recent DX release that allows you to do instancing on current hardware, which is pretty wacky. That crowd demo we did before that came out, so that actually was doing some other tricks that I'll talk about in a minute. Legal tricks, not like vendor tricks. Additionally, another thing that you want to do that I think is probably the interesting step of this is to use shaders to generate uniqueness across the instances. So like in this example, in this scene in Shrek, they actually have a one model that they use for all those cabbages, but they've modeled that cabbage in a way that it can have things like maybe some bone matrices or some scale factors and some other kinds of things that allows them to maybe tint it or open some of them up a little more, turn some of them, scale them, stretch them, things like that to make them look more unique. I mean, clearly it's still a very storybook, look, and you've got a grid of stuff, so they're obviously very self-similar, but you're able to get them to look a lot more unique than they would otherwise. And I'm certain they're doing that for basically everything else there too, like all those sunflowers. In practice, like I mentioned, there's actually a new entry point in Direct3D, so this is something you can play around with now and draw multiple instances in one shot. Far Cry put this in, and for a representative forest scene in their game, so again, this is just one particular scene, in this scene where they had 24 different kinds of vegetation of various kinds of grasses, bushes, and trees, they can get some pretty good efficiency. Their draw calls in this scene were reduced from 2,500 draw calls per frame to 430. And that includes all the non-instanced stuff, buildings and the land and the characters and things like that weren't instanced. They don't really sort their foliage, so that helps this number a whole lot. because they can just blat out all the bushes of one particular type without regard to how they interleave with the others. But nonetheless, I think that's encouraging that those kinds of numbers are achievable already today in chipping games. And that was not engineered for this. So instancing was something that they just put in later because they didn't need to sort. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know what the overall speed up was as a result of that. It could have been, again, it could have been one of those things where it wasn't even the bottleneck, but I don't know that for sure. I'd have to ask. Again, though, if you architect for this kind of thing, and I think particularly if you're targeting sort of next-gen hardware and things like that, I think you could get some great data amplification rates. In this case, we're drawing hundreds of guys. There's, in any one, I think the max number in any single frame is somewhere upwards of 700 guys. They have 20 bones each. They're using 4-matrix skinning and per-pixel lighting and all kinds of pretty normal stuff. They have about, I think, around 1,000 polys each, just again to give you some more ballpark. There are 1,400 guys in the data set. Actually, there's basically a clump of 200 that gets repeated 7 times because we had to do that because of the way we used the AI implant middleware product to do all the collision avoidance stuff. That's all pre-processed. But then we run these guys down the field like crazy. And we draw them 4 at a time. So the reason that we limited our artist to 20 bones was so that the aggregate over 4 guys was 80 bones. So we have an object, which is 4 guys. And then we make one draw index primitive call to draw stamping out 4 guys. Now, one thing that you notice if you look at this, actually, why don't I just run the real thing? It's a lot easier. One thing that you'll notice when you look at this is that they don't just look the same. They look pretty damn similar because they're the same model and they're the same run cycle and stuff. We can only afford so many art resources at a hardware vendor. But one thing, we did play some games to make them look unique, and I think these are generically applicable and things you should think about. So if we look at some of these guys, you'll see that they have kind of some different tinting to them. Like this guy, this guy's clearly blue and green and gray, and they have actually different patches on them and stuff like that, little decorations. Their guns are different colors, so they actually have different like decal sets on them and things. So we actually have this other channel. So each of those 4 guys sort of knows which guy he is, and he can look into the vertex shader constant store. So the zeroth guy will look into a particular location in the vertex shader constant store to look up his ID. And this guy, this is his ID, just drawn as a color. And so then that ID can downstream drive all the pixel shader logic, which tints him a certain color or selects from a certain decal map, decal set. The way that we implemented the decal sets was essentially taking different decals and kind of laying them next to each other in a single texture and just doing some texture coordinate tricks. Going forward, though, texture arrays are kind of an obvious way to do a lot more aggressive texture switching per instance. And of course, once you have flow control and pixel shaders too, that blows it wide open, because you can use these kinds of seeds as ways to do control flow through your pixel shaders. And essentially what this is doing is allowing you to do texture swaps and basically shader swaps mid draw call, right? Think about it that way. Like the big bitch in the last couple of years has been how expensive that kind of stuff is, right? Like switching texture handles and shaders. But now you can essentially control a lot of those kinds of things mid draw call when you're doing this. And when you're doing it per instance, you're gonna for this guy, he's gonna go down the same path for every one of his pixels, right? And so is this guy. So you're not doing like crazy interleaving of your control paths, on a pixel by pixel basis. You're actually gonna get good parallelism.
On the GPU now rather than the CPU.
Yeah, the question is about instruction cache misses on the GPU. And I mean, yeah, you'll have to tune for that kind of thing, I guess. It's not really. I don't foresee that. Possibly, but I don't foresee that being the bottleneck by a long shot.
No, it probably isn't, but I'm just saying.
Yeah. 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 I'd rather shift it there. It seems that way, but the frequency has also changed. And the cost to change is totally different as well. Like in the way the APIs are currently designed, those kinds of switches are a real drain on the CPU. So migrating that stuff down lower, I think, is going to be the way to go.
Worth pointing out that we don't just have to deal with the overhead on the chip right now due to context switches like that, but just calling the API call right now,
Yeah, I mean, isn't the Halo port isn't proof that it's not us, right? I mean, it's D3D and the CPU, right? I mean, the Halo port from Xbox to PC that was just the straight port making the same kind of calls ran like crap on the PC compared to the way it ran on Xbox. Same chip, right? Totally different software, and that's I think that's an indication of what you're suggesting is not the problem. So, correct, Chris, I hope that didn't sound too bad, Chris. Oh, sure. Oh, the FX, okay, I gotcha. I didn't realize they used the FX library. Okay. Go ahead, Casey.
I was just going to say, before you closed the demo, could you show the smoke thing?
Oh, God, damn it. Yeah, that's okay. It actually didn't take that long to load. I'll do it again. Yeah, my bad. Yeah, go ahead, Jay. Yeah.
Say we have we run some of the half like 2 on Xbox, and we have cases where we small enough matches to 733 enter Xbox, as opposed to 3.2 for PC.
Right.
Same
level, so. Yep. Yeah, it's true. Like we built this for a reason. It's we made these kind of API changes to that instance thing that's already slammed into DX9 and for a reason, because it's a kind of a really dire problem. But then also you want to think about this for future platforms and APIs and so on, as you're architecting fundamentally. So I'll actually. No, they're much cheesier than that. I can explain that if you like. They're pretty great, actually. They use the similar kind of instancing trick, except we do them 200 at a time. They are little quads with flipbook animations that are pre-generated. So we're cheap. You can probably see the quad that's underneath each guy. Can you see it? Like this guy's quad is kind of like right here. For that guy, it's the same flipbook. They're just selecting from, and it's actually that's actually stored in a 3D texture that's not mipmapped because it's such a fuzzy image. We draw that quad, so each quad knows has a place in the vertex shader constant store that says where am I, what is my tilt, because it can't just it's where am I in 3D space, what is my kind of slope, and which frame of animation should I be, and we actually managed to pack all that into a VEC4, I think. So we can do 200 of those in one shot.
You're kind of just drawing one squad for each of these.
Yeah.
You're drawing it on uneven terrain.
Right.
How are you doing that without the shadow cutting the guys, the landing on the
terrain? Very carefully. No, just carefully. Yeah, I could probably come down low and show you, show you maybe how it's floating. Yeah, I think you could kind of see it there. Actually, let me see if I can put it. Oops, what are you doing? This thing is tuned for a different kind of scale. Yeah, well, okay, right, yeah, that's a good point. Oh, there's a Z-buffered wireframe, let's try that. Yeah, you can see it's like a little bit change the scale of the world. Or the input. Yeah, there it is. Say that again? Oh, right now it's probably redoing everything every frame. Actually, I doubt our engine is designed for pause mode. tends not to be. If this is running at what? Where's the frame rate? That's frame number. Actually, I don't think FPS is on there, is it? No, it's actually, no, the frame rate's not on there, sorry. That's just raw time. The frame rate's not on there. Sorry. Teasing you with one stat you wanted to see. So yeah, let's go see the fluid flow stuff.
There definitely were a few scenes moving together where the frame rate kind of
goes. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think that it might get down to around 20 in some cases when you've got, like, you know, 700 something guys on the screen or something. You know, of course we are culling those little guys in clumps of four, and you know the four guys are, you know, basically near each other. We know their bounding regions and stuff. So we do cull. Here's some smoke. The way it's mapped onto these little squashed ellipsoid things is not great. So it could look better, actually. Let's see, which I think it's this key. Right, there it is. So there's the off-screen obvious Stokes thingy that's just kind of going. That one's actually pretty simple. You could probably just do that with noise or something. But, you know, when you want to get interesting flow and drop, you can put obstacles into this as well. You can tag cells as you know, as blocked and things like that. All right, so I'll finish up quickly here. This is just kind of, I just want to finish up just mentioning, like, some people are thinking of this even further, right? Not just taking little parts of their world and maybe making them procedural or instanced or whatever. Some guys, like, practically every game of Age of Empire I ever played was on a procedural world, right? Like, the 2D guys have been doing this for a long time. You know, the demo scene guys do tons of this. They actually have tools that are essentially procedural world-building tools that they author so that they can fit into a first-person shooter into 96K. Some people are doing this at author time now to just place junk around environments. And also at Graphin, they're doing even runtime stuff. I guess I mentioned this sort of already, that, you know, the 96K game competition at Breakpoint this year, you know, these guys had a first-person shooter, and these are some screenshots. You can you know, go to their website, and they have both their game and their tools, actually, online that you can go ahead and play around with, that they use to generate the textures and the environments procedurally. I'm not suggesting you necessarily go do that, but it's an interesting existence proof, I must say. Yeah, definitely worth 96K download, yeah. So, I don't know, you guys probably know Chaz Boyd and Herb Marcellus. They were at Microsoft before. This is Emogence is their new company, and they're doing this game Graphin, in which the environments themselves are actually procedurally generated on the fly as you traverse around the environment, and then probably chucked out and regenerated as you come back, things like that. Now, some things are authored by artists like that brick texture or whatever. They paint certain stuff, but they're going pretty darn far with the procedural world thing. Some related areas that I clearly don't have time to talk about are, you know, higher order surfaces. This is kind of an obvious way to amplify data that a lot of people are already familiar with. And you're going to have more than N patches in the future, so just be aware of that. And obviously things like plants and terrain, these are massive, and terrain is the one that you really got to be careful as a GPU vendor trying to pitch to people, because that one's so fundamental to gameplay. You know, clearly getting guys to walk across procedural terrain is going to be an interesting thing. So anyway, we talked about a bunch of loosely related topics all fitting under the umbrella of data amplification. You know, compositing different signals together to make noise being kind of an obvious one. Doing more hybrid approaches like Sean talked about in Game Developer. Wang tiles, flow synthesis, and then even going to like a real ocean water synthesis, you know, existing application. And I talked about instancing, which I think is probably the real low-hanging fruit for you guys. So do we have any other questions besides the discussion we had already? Yep, John?
I had a comment on the instancing thing, mm-hmm. which is really, I guess, a back-end compliment, which is by the time the instancing stuff came about, at the same time, the driver manufacturer, specifically API, has done such a good job of improving your driver
drivers that the cost isn't as painful as it used to be for small batch sizes.
So wow. Really?
With large numbers, and if the object I'm interfacing has a high bird count, it's actually slower.
Interesting. Okay. Well, thanks, and yeah. Okay. Do you send it to DevRel? Okay, cool. Yeah, Casey.
So can you be any more specific on what you mean by real tessellation?
Probably not. Sorry. Not here. Not here. I know. I guess you want to look at it in that little narrow window. Yeah, sure. But yeah, I mean, and things like being able to scatter would be really nice going forward as well. So yeah, we're looking at that. That's an oversimplification, Chris. But that, it's funny, anyways.
Real tessellation techniques are coming. If we can't elaborate on the real tessellation techniques, how about the coming part?
Not here. I'm sorry, Casey. He's sitting right next to you, so. He kicked my ass. All right. Thanks, guys. Face forward.
Open closed fist.
Yeah.
I just want to give you one data point from an Xbox perspective. One of the things that my team does is performance of an Xbox game. The majority of Xbox games are CPU bound. In other words, they're weak.
Okay, wait, are we not asking about GPU? Okay, yeah, that's what I meant. Okay, so who thinks that GPU is practical for your next game, which maybe you haven't quite started yet, but may start soon? Go ahead and hand raise. Okay, so we got about 8. How about next game? So maybe you start it in a couple years if you're on schedule now. About the same. And who thinks never, ever in your life? About the same. So it's 8, 8, and 8, and then a bunch of abstentions, I think. All right. So
yeah, for part of the GPU means general purpose.
Yeah.
Not
practical.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we have a lot of audio work, and I think it's a very similarity
Yeah, it's true. Okay, we are. How important is it, Casey?
It's relatively important, but it would probably start with a lot of chain reactions. So.
Oh, come on, ask it.
Ask it, and then we'll go to a break.
Well, I was gonna say, it seems it's kind of a weird situation because most of the things of next generation hardware is supposedly having more processors. So you're kind of adding yet another processor that's somewhere else. So it's unclear how that curve's gonna go, right?
It is very unclear, is my opinion.
So it's hard to say, like, moving to the GPU versus CPU when, okay, there's going to be, like, other stuff, too. And even, like, a PlayStation 2, there already is, right? You have, like, you already have other kind of coprocessory things. And so it's like, you know, I don't know.
I have no idea. I mean,